Hey, this is Cheech Marin, and you're listening to Radio Aslan, 88.3 FM, KUCR. Listen.
Órale pues, Raza. Welcome to Chicano Highlights. I am your host, Beto, and we have a very special guest here with us. We have Mr. Cheech Marin. ¿Cómo estás, compañero?
Muy bien, ¿y usted?
Órale, pues. Listen, eh? Ahí vamos, ¿verdad?
Aquí navegando.
All right, so let's start off with your past. ¿De dónde son tus padres?
My grandparents were all born in Mexico, different parts in Tepic, Nayarit, Chihuahua, Guaymas, and Tucson. And I kept asking my grandmother how to do a report for school, you know, where all my grandparents were from and everybody in my family. And so I went to her and says, well, my dad says you were born in U.S. and my mom says you were born in Mexico. So where were you born? Tucson. I said, okay. And I walked away and she goes, Mexico. So I didn't know if it was the Alzheimer's kicking in or against that. And so I went back. Well, my dad, were you born in Mexico or U.S.? She goes, Tucson. And then I walked away, Mexico. And so, well, what, was it Tucson? Was it Mexico? Since Tucson was Mexico, pendejo. She was that perfect example of the border. She didn't cross the border. The border crossed her. You know, because she was, when she was born, it was Mexico. Wow. And it became a territory that became a state after that.
Wow.
All my parents were all born in L.A., as I was born in L.A., and all my children were born in L.A.
¿Cómo se llaman tus padres? What are their names?
Carmen, Luis, another Luis, and Lupe.
All right. And do you have brothers and sisters?
I do. I have four younger sisters. I'm the oldest. I'm the only boy in the family, in the whole family. So I'm the patriarch, I guess, at this point.
Orale.
Last one. I think that means last one living. And my sisters are nine. I have twin sisters that are 9 years younger than another, two other sisters that are younger than that.
All right. And where did you go to elementary school, middle school, and high school?
I started elementary at Trinity Street School in South Central L.A. And that was when I was from 1 to 10, I lived in South Central LA, 36 in San Pedro. And when I lived there, it was all black neighborhood. It was 90-something% black. And then now it's 100% Latino. And then when I was 10, my family moved from South Central to Granada Hills out in the San Fernando Valley. And so one day everybody was black, and the next day everybody was white. And so I was the only Chicano in both places, you know. So I was like, wow, how does this work, you know? So it was pretty cool because it was really inner city and then country. You know, we moved out until there was orange groves everywhere. So it was cool. I got to see both sides, you know, from a distinct Chicano perspective.
Wow. High school?
High school, I went to Alemany High School, Bishop Alemany in San Fernando Valley. I went there 4 years, and then after I graduated from there, I went to Cal State Northridge. But it was not Northridge, it was called Valley State. It wasn't part of the Cal State system there, it changed over to Cal State Northridge.
Did you go immediately to Northridge after high school?
Uh-huh.
Really? Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And what's your BA in?
English.
Wow.
As a second language. No. No, it was English. I started out in political science because I think I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. You know, so I took some law classes and I said, nah, right away, that's not for me. And so I was always a reader, a big reader and a student of literature. So I started, I took English and that worked out really well for me. You know, I meet a lot of kids now, you know, when I go and speak in colleges and the average college student changes their major three times, at least three times during their college tenure. And I tell them, well, if you don't know what you want to do, you know, because everybody's on you to pick a major right away. If you don't know what to take liberal arts because, you know, you learn a bit about everything. And somewhere during that process, you're going to find something that sparks your interest and then you can major in that. But if you just major in liberal arts throughout your college career, you're going to come out being educated, well-read, you know, and knowledgeable about a lot of different subjects. So I think it's a good major. And you see that coming back around nowadays.
And how did you get your name, Cheech?
Cheech. Cheech is short for Chicharron.
Órale.
And then when I came home from the hospital, when I was a little baby, the first day, you know, little babies all curled up, you know, and my Uncle Bono looked in the crib and says, "Ay, pero es un chicharrón." And so that was his job, my Uncle Bono, was to give everybody a nickname, you know, because everybody in our family had at least three nicknames. And so I was Chicharrón, and then she got shortened to Cheech, but only in the family. My real name is Richard, my real first name. And so at school, people call me Richard, but in the family, it was always Cheech.
All right. And so then, you went straight to college. Tell me what motivated you to get an education, because most Chicanos were not going to school.
My dad, who was born in L.A. and was a policeman, LAPD for 30 years. You know, I knew everything about the police. I grew up at the police academy, and he always stressed education. He eventually went back to school, got his BA, and then a teaching credential. He taught police science in the junior college system for the next 30 years. You know, but always stressed education. You're going to college. It wasn't a matter of what college you're going to. You're going to college. You know, okay. And it would be great if you were a lawyer, you know, because right. He'd come out of the law enforcement. You know? So I said, yeah, I was interested in law. One of the best classes I ever took, I took a year of constitutional law my first year there, and that's still one of my favorite classes. But it was stressed. And all my family, all my sisters went to college, and you know, we're educated because that's the only way to advance.
Exactly. It's the only way to move forward. Yeah. Now, after college, ¿verdad? What jobs did you hold? What did you do?
Well, my very last semester of college, you take all the classes that you've been putting off for 4 years, you know, like sociology 110 or, you know, all those classes. And so I still had a few open spots, and I was standing in line to, you know, sign up for classes. And there was this really cute girl that I had a class with the year before. And I says, "Well, so what are you taking?" She said, "Oh, I'm taking in pottery. You should try that. We got a couple empty spaces." And so I said, "Yeah, sure, you know." And so I took pottery because I was always an artist in search of a medium. You know, I knew I was an artist of some kind. You know, I was always a musician, so that was. But I knew I was attracted to the arts and knew a lot about art and everything. And so I said, "Well, okay, I'll just take a pottery class, and that'll be good. I'll be next to this cute girl." And that flipped me out. Pottery, it just took over my life. I quit my job. I got a $900 NEDA loan and did pottery from the time I got up to the time I went to bed at night. And then eventually, I went to Canada to be an apprentice for a very famous potter. My pottery teacher had this student that lived up in Canada, and he was still opening a pottery. He says, maybe you can be his assistant or something. So, okay. And it coincided with my political activities, too, because it was right in the middle of the Vietnam War, and it was a very, very agitated there. That's where I told you all these speakers are coming to Northridge. I mean, Eldridge Cleaver came to talk, Timothy Leary, Reyes de Arena, and all that. And I was really greatly affected by them. But the one person that really affected me was a guy named David Harris. And he was the head of the draft resistance movement. And his theory was that you stop this war by not participating, you know, being the universal soldier thing. So, and that's the only thing that made sense to me of all the speakers that came there. And so I was part of the draft resistance movement, and so they were after us, the feds. And General Hershey, who was the director of the draft at that time, issued the statement, the proclamation, that anybody who protested at the draft boards or burned their draft cards or you know, did any kind of those activities, which I had done all of those, would be immediately reclassified from 2S, which was a student, and classified 1A, will be drafted and sent to the front lines in Vietnam. That was his fix. And it was obviously First Amendment issues. And everybody knew that that would be worked its way through the courts, which it eventually did. But in the meantime, he was starting to arrest all these people. And they were getting sentenced to 8 years in Leavenworth. And so I said, no, this is, I did something right here. I didn't do something wrong here. So it coincided with me going to Canada to be a potter. And so they eventually, my last couple of weeks, they changed my classification. I was still in school, changed my classification, but that I was waiting for them to issue me a notice for a physical. By that time, I was in Canada, and I spent the next 3 years in Canada. And that's where I made my way to Vancouver and met Tommy Chong. And that's how we got together. Then when I came back in the United States, I was still wanted by the FBI. So I snuck in using a phony ID of my friend Bill with his picture on it. they didn't even have a computer back in those days. You know, I showed up at the airport and the immigration. I says, I'm going to do interviews with. I was working for this magazine, a rock and roll magazine called Poppin', and so I'm going down to the States and do interviews with Jefferson Airplane and everybody. And they're going, and I says, "You have any ideas?" So yeah, I pulled out my friend's driver's license with his picture on it.
Wow.
And hello, he said, "Okay, go ahead." And so I came back. So I was back about 6 months, and my case went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, along with 600 other cases of class action, got thrown out immediately. So this is obviously but what they tried to do is draft me again immediately. So the next day, almost, I got a notice to appear for physical. But it just so happens when I was in Canada for those 3 years that I had broken my leg skiing very badly, because I was a Chicano. I didn't know about skiing. Right. I had never seen snow in my life. Mm-hmm. And I got up into Canada, and it was in Alberta. It was the coldest winter in 80 years, man. And so they took me up to Banff. It's a beautiful national park resort. Put some skis on me, pushed me down the hill. I was fast, too, boy. I just couldn't stop. I got down the bottom of the mountain, ran out of snow, was in the parking lot, and hit a bus and broke my leg in half. Eventually, that got me out of the draft.
Wow.
Yeah, because it was a compound fracture, and I had pins and things. And so I guess it was a lucky break.
Te rayaste.
Lucky break, huh?
Now we know for next time, just break your leg.
Just break your leg, yeah. Orale. Some people were doing all kinds of stuff, you know, to get out, but, you know.
What year was this, Musselman?
This is like 60... I went up there in 68, mm-hmm. So 68, 69, 70.
Wow.
And half of 70.
So you're right there in the critical time when all the walkouts were going on, yeah. And the August 1970 protest in L.A. donde mataron a Rubén Salazar.
Yeah. That was with people think that there's a lot of stuff going on now, man. They were killing people, killing students on campus, man. Kent State and other places, man. And it was rugged, man. Upset the government. But then there was this guy Nixon telling you what was what. And it's come out that they'd been lying to the American public for ever since Eisenhower about this whole war. You know,
it was tough. It was tough. A very, very tough time.
Yeah.
So you said that you're also a musician. What do you play?
I play guitar since I was 11.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, 11 times I played guitar, but mostly I was a singer. I was this little anomaly. I was a little Chicano kid singer that could sing in tune. At five, little squeaky voice, but in tune. I could stay on tune. And so I had this friend of my mother's who had a little small-time record label in the neighborhood, and he would make records. And so I was this little novelty act, this little kid. Amorcito corazón. And I could sing these songs, but in tune. So I think he sold 100 records in the neighborhood. It was really I was popular.
Right, right. So how did you get into the movie industry? I mean, you hooked up with Chong, right? Yeah. Cheech and Chong. Uh-huh. And, of course, you guys came up with the name, right, from both of your names, right? Uh-huh. And Chong is, that's actually his last name, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And how did you get into the movie industry? You guys started doing comedic spots, right, at many different bars.
Well, we started off when I met Tommy. He was a musician all his life, too, R&B, a guitar player. And he had a band that was signed to Motown called Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers. And it was the first mixed band ever signed to Motown. It was black, white, and in his case, half Chinese. And they had this big hit tune called Does Your Mama Know About Me, which Tommy wrote. He wrote the lyrics for it. And it was a big hit, and then the band broke up, or he got fired, or went can't stop. And so he went back to Vancouver, where he was from. And when he got there, his family owned this nightclub, which became Vancouver's first strip bar. And it's right in the worst part of town, man. Main and Pender, right down there, and Junkieville, Winoville. It was tough, so he started this. But when he was on the road with Bobby Taylor in the Vancouvers, he had discovered improv theater. You know, he saw the Second City in Chicago, and he saw the Committee in San Francisco, and he was intrigued. Because he was a musician that never said a word on stage, just played guitar, and so he was intrigued by this improv theater. So he'd go every night and watch them. And so when he came back to Vancouver, he says, "That's what I want to do. I want to start an improv theater." And so he did in the topless bar. So it was topless improv. What it was actually, what it became at the end, it was hippie burlesque. It was classic burlesque theater, strippers, comedians, you know, but we had this improv acting a comedy to go along with the strippers, you know. So, and so Tommy tells the girls, he says, okay, we're starting a new deal here. So we're going to have guys, you girls are going to be actresses now. You're no longer strippers. You're actresses, but you get naked, but you're actresses, so you get paid less. You know? And so he started this group with a couple of his buddies, and they had a mime artist in the group with, you know, white face mime artist, a little like Marcel Marceau, and a really great guitar player, classical guitar player, and his other friends, three strippers and him and then I came into the group after it was going a little while, and I got introduced to Tommy, and I told him I was this great improv actor from L.A. and I was in all these companies, and I had seen all these companies. I wasn't in them, you know, but I was improving a resume at that time, you know. And so he said, oh, okay, so he hired me as a writer for the group. So I started writing for this group, and I came up with some stuff early that they liked. There I was, man. I was a semi-stripper.
Orale. And so then you guys started recording albums, right? You guys started off with the albums, right? Comedy albums?
Well, we were a stage act first because of the strip bar. And then when we came back to L.A., we started playing whatever clubs, mostly black clubs. You know, because that's what we knew, and there was still this black club circuit in L.A. that they were used to, the kind of a floor show, you know, where the professional MC would come out, introduce a professional comedian, he would introduce the main act, and you know, and so we fit in there, and we were doing stuff that they could understand, because Tommy came from a black neighborhood in Calgary, Amber Valley, and I came from a black neighborhood in L.A., South Central, so we knew that community really well, so they related to us, and we talked a lot about dope, so, you know, everybody related to that. And so we had this whole thing where we would have this during the week, or so we played all black clubs, and then on some days we would come to Hollywood and play the white clubs, you know, like the Troubadour, or the Ice House, or all these other little folk clubs, you know, they were, because part of our act was that too, you know, we could speak to all those audiences at the same time. And so we did that as long as we could, and you know, made a living, sort of. And eventually we got seen by this guy named Lou Adler, who was a big record producer. He was the biggest record producer in the world at the time. He had produced the Mamas and Papas and Sam Cooke and Spirit, Monterey Pop. And he was just about to release Tapestry by Carole King. Mm-hmm. and when he signed us, and there was only a few artists on the label, and it was right in the explosion of albums. People were buying albums now, so he signed us up to do an album, I guess, you know. So we had to figure out how we were going to do that, you know, how we were going to translate what we were doing on stage to audio. Because you couldn't see us, you could only hear us. So we had to do things that sounded funny.
Right. What was your first album?
It's called Cheech and Chong.
And how many albums do you have altogether?
Six.
Six of them.
There's
okay.
six movies, six albums.
Wow.
I don't know. It's a sign of the devil, I think.
Hopefully not.
We need another six.
So that was your first album. And how did that go across the nation? How did people accept it or not?
Well, we came in right at the beginning of FM radio, and radio was switching over from being AM top 40 hits. Hey, the one to watch, and we're going to play this 20 times this hour, you know, until all of a sudden this album explosion started happening, and people wanted to hear the whole album or the different cuts. And that's when the rise of FM radio, and they talk very slowly like this. We're going to play something from the new Jefferson Airplane. We're going to play the whole album. It's going to take 2 hours, and I'm going to go to the bathroom, you know. And so we came in that era, you know. And it was new because, unlike all our contemporaries, Richard Pryor, Lily Tomlin, George Carlin, Steve Martin, all those guys were making comedy albums at the time. Their albums consisted of recording their live act. There was an audience in there. You could hear them. Ours, we went into the studio and created these scenarios with no audience. So there was no laugh track, you know. But it really played perfectly into this new audience that was listening to albums with headphones on, you know. And we did all kinds of sound effects and music and layers. And that's when all of a sudden the recording mechanism switched from a 4-track to 24 tracks. You know, and then we could fill all these tracks. Oh, let's put a glockenspiel on here now. You know, so that we were musicians. We approached it as musicians. Oh, let's get a bass in here or something. You know, and so we kept constructing these, and it went over well. It was a perfect thing for the times.
All right. So how did you get into your first movie now? Okay, so you did all the albums, mm-hmm. and then how does the first movie come about?
Well, you know, we'd been traveling on the road and making records like nonstop for the next 8 years, and we used to do over 300 dates a year. You know, we were like on the road all the time and blah blah blah. And then when we weren't on the road, we'd come back home and we'd record. We'd go right into a studio and start the next album. And sometimes we'd record on the road, and so it was like this 8-year cycle of like that's all we did. And we could do it, you know, because we were young enough. But after a while, 300 days a year, you don't know where you are anymore, you know. So we says, and we looked at it and said, well, obviously the thing we have to do is make movies. All our heroes, all the comedy teams that we knew about, Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy, Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis, all those guys eventually made movies. And that's where they got their big success and big fame. So I said, well, that's what we got to do. We got to make a movie. So we took a year off right at the height of the record and the stage success, and we wrote a movie. And long story short, what eventually became Up in Smoke, and eventually we got some kind of deal and made the movie, and it got released, and all of a sudden, just like the records, it exploded. Nobody thought we was going to, it was Cheech and Chong, what do they know, they don't know anything. And it was this huge, giant hit movie. It was super successful everywhere, and it kept going on. We're just celebrating this year the 40th anniversary of Up in Smoke. And it's still relevant today, and it's played all over the world. And what it coincided with, not only was movies actually, music was a much bigger medium at that time because everybody, all the kids were listening to music and albums on the radio. And, you know, the movie industry at that time was making stuff like Hello, Dolly, you know, or something like that, or Operation Petticoat, or, you know. And so here comes this new wave of filmmakers, you know, and then they're making all this edgy stuff, and we fit in right in there. And so we made big hit movies, one after the other, just like the records. We would be in pre-production and post-production simultaneously, all the time, until we, you know, couldn't do that anymore, and then we fell out.
Well, what do you think about, of course, the movie industry, the, you know, being at the big, you know, these big old cinema places?
Yeah, there was. What I think of us going in there?
Yeah.
Oh, it's the natural order of the things, you know. God willed it.
¿Verdad?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, no, I was like, you know, I first time I ever saw the Up in Smoke with an audience was as an audience in Dallas, Texas, and they were just putting it out there to see what would happen. They didn't know, and it was the most laughter I've ever heard in any theater ever anywhere. And man, I couldn't believe it was explosive, and wow! And we were having a bello with Adler, who was our producer director at the time. He was directed this movie, and we were having a battle with him about a lot of stuff. And so we didn't know how the movie was doing. We went out there, so I called the head of Paramount, Frank Mancuso, who was, you know, I knew at the time. I says, "Hey, Frank, I want to check up on our movie Up in Smoke. How's it doing?" And so he goes, and so he starts reading me numbers. Well, in El Paso, in San Antonio, it did this and this and this, and in Dallas it did it, and Houston it did this and this and this and this. I says, "Is that good?" And he goes, "Jeez, this is a blockbuster." And he said it like he described it like he had just seen the world's most beautiful woman.
Oh, wow.
This is a blockbuster. You know? And I go, that's good, huh? Yeah. And so then we started, and then once again, we started making one movie after the other.
All right. And so then after the movies,
yeah,
there was a small fallout between you and Chong.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. You know, we'd been together every day, sleeping in the same room for years and years, and like we just got sick of each other. I mean, you don't want to hear this other guy, no matter what he has to say, both of us, you know. And Tommy kind of like, his head exploded a little bit, you know,
and he
tried to ego out on me, and he was the creator, and I said, well, you know, I think we've kind of come to the point where we need a break. And so long story, I have a book out called
¿Cómo se llama?
Chicha's Not My Real Name, But Don't Call Me Chong.
All right.
And you can find it in bookstores or go online and you can find it.
All right.
But anyways, we broke up, but at the same time I had created this Born in East L.A. movie.
Uh-huh.
That's when it, and then I got offered to do, before that, I got offered to do a movie that became Born in East L.A., but by myself. The studio just wanted me to do it by myself because it was a different story. And I said, well, this is about time. This is a perfect time, and I'll just do this. I still wanted to make movies with Chong, but he was all...
Yeah, you know, again, money, time spent with a lot of, you know, with a person, people just end up going off in different directions, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's also growth, you know, that, you know, it's time to turn the page, it's time to go our separate ways, it's time to do other things, you know. And so then, so you did Born in East L.A., which was another movie, and then, you came out in a lot of Disney films.
Yeah.
You have a vast, vast, vast collection of stuff that you've done over the years. Now you also have collected art.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, you know, I was a part of this little group of cousins. I had these three other cousins who were, and we were like an anomaly. We were this blue collar working class Chicano kids that were. We went to all Catholic school, and we became academics. We like really, you know, smart, and we challenged each other, and with this little group, and my cousin Louis, who was the head guide, he was just a brilliant kid, brilliant, and he assigned us all topics, Okay, so Regine, you go learn about the Middle Ages, and you bring it back to the group. And Lolly, learn about, stenography. And Cheech, you learn about art. And so, okay, well, how do you do that? So I go to the library, and I took out all the art books. And so I took out every single art book that they had and looked at the pictures. Okay, that's Pissarro. That's Picasso. That's Goya. So I learned about art that way, the whole history of art. And so when it came time to the gap in my knowledge was contemporary art, and I knew some names, but I didn't really know who was what. And so I started going around to galleries in the west side of L.A., and that's when I discovered these Chicano painters. And these painters are really good, because I knew what good painting was at that time, because I'd studied it all my life, and I'd gone to museums. And you have to see paintings live. That's the takeaway from this all, is you have to see paintings live, because it's like, if you don't see them live, it's like looking at a neon sign that's not turned on. Mm-hmm. There's a whole different quality to paint when you see it live. And so I started seeing these Chicano painters, and I'm like, well, these painters are really good, man. It's like, well, how come they're not getting no shelf space? And so then I said, they were being kept out of museums because they were not considered fine artists. They were considered agitprop folk arts, And I said, well, no, these guys have got all kinds of stuff happening here. It was a perfect storm. I knew what the art was. I had the money to collect it because I was employed at that time for a bunch of years in a row. And I also had celebrity in order to promote it. And that was really the perfect storm. So I started collecting this art. And at some point, one of my friends in the art world says, you got to show this. You have this big collection. It doesn't do you any good in storage. You can only put so much of it in your house. Because very early, I realized that I can buy these big-ass paintings because nobody else was, because you can't put them in your house. A 24-by-12-foot painting, it's not going to go over your couch. Maybe it'll go over your couch and your kitchen and your back porch. But I realized really, really early that I'm collecting this for a purpose. I didn't exactly know what that purpose was, but I knew there was a purpose. So I started buying these big monumental paintings. They were great. And all the masterpieces of art, of Chicano art, were still available to collect when I start, and I had the money to do it.
How many do you have? Más o menos.
Más o menos, it's edging towards 800.
Wow, that is a lot.
It's a lot of paintings. I'm a collector. I'm an inveterate collector. I collected marbles and baseball cards and matchbook covers and can't say what came up. I had a mania for codification,
right.
But I started collecting these paintings. So my friend said, you gotta show these. I looked around for a way to do that, and it's easier said than done. Yeah. It was like, hey, I'm gonna show the paintings. Okay, well, it costs to show your paintings. It costs for any museum to agree to show them. But that's where the celebrity comes in. They all knew Cheech or Cheech and Chong. And, okay, well. And first of all, it was like attitude. Yeah. What is this doper going to come and tell us about Chicano art, man, and tell us what's up? I got a PhD in Chicano studies, And so it was like that, But once they started opening the crates, and then it changed.
Wow. Now, what is the difference between just regular art, right, American art, yeah, and Chicano art?
Well, they're both the same. Chicano art is American art. It is American art. This is the recognition factor is now coming where it wasn't even considered art at the beginning. And I kept, every time I had a discussion with a museum, and they said, well, we have a Latin American. I says, well, that's wonderful for you. But this is American art made by Americans about American subjects. This is American. I kept repeating that. This is American art. And eventually, they didn't want to hear that. They didn't want to hear that, man, And so I got a lot of pushback on it. But the forces that were going forward were much greater than the forces that were manning the barriers, And I got, I started touring them. But in order to launch a tour on the scale that I did, you need sponsorship. You know, you have to, somebody's got to pay for that to ship the paintings from one museum to the other and advertise and to put on programs and blah, blah, blah. And I joined up, I got sponsorship by the Target stores.
Wow.
And Hewlett-Packard, who put, Hewlett-Packard and Target put the original seed money in to actually produce the show. Because it was not only a painting show, it was an interactive show that had a lot of different aspects in it, and it cost a lot of money, you know, to ship it from one. So, but eventually we came up with this tour, the Chicano Visions tour, that was sponsored by the Target stores, went on for 7 years, over 14 major venues in the United States: the Smithsonian, the DeYoung, the LACMA, the Walker in Minneapolis, all major museums, you know, because I said, this is the entree of Chicano art into the American mainstream. This is, you know, but I essentially didn't want to play small ethnic museums at the beginning. I said, because we're just preaching to the choir here. We have to enter the mainstream, and this is the acceptance of Chicano art into the mainstream. And so, and that went on for 7 years, man, and like, and we'd have 8,000-10,000 people at the openings, and unheard of. No show they ever had for any artist had that many. And so it opened up a lot of eyes. And then from then, I just kept touring different aspects of the collection, you know, works on paper, works just from Texas, works just from L.A., you know. And at this point, we've played almost 60 museums.
Wow.
With a private collection, which is key, because the museums don't want to show private collections.
Right.
Because I understand, because they have their own curatorial voice that they want to enforce, and they don't want you to enrich the value of your collection by showing it in a museum. And I understand that. But my argument was, well, I have this collection because you don't.
Right.
And there was no answer for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we are in 2018, and we're talking now. There's a big commotion in Riverside, California, about building an actual Cheech Museum.
Yeah, baby. Well, it's already built. I mean, it's a town library. It's a beautiful mid-century building, 62,420 square feet, 420. It was meant to be beautiful building, and the city fathers, mostly under the direction of John Russo, was the city manager. I was doing an art show, just coincided with I was doing an art show in Riverside at RAM, and works on paper, and they had to, they were building a new library for the town. They're building it right now, and so they had to repurpose this building, either repurpose it or have it sit empty for a number of years and see what happens. And so they had been down the road talking to some children's museum or something, and then it fell out. At the same time, I opened the show, when it was the biggest show they ever had by a factor of five at the museum. A couple of light bulbs went out off in somebody's mind. I says, why don't we have Cheech's collection enshrined here at the thing? They came to me with this proposition. I didn't understand them at first. You know, I'm like, what? You want me to buy a museum? I don't know, man. I'm doing okay, but I don't know if I'm gonna buy a museum. No. We want to give you the museum to house the collection.
Permanent.
Permanent. You have to give us your collection, but okay. Because I came to the point where I realized, well, what am I collecting this for? What good does it do me to have a collection? I says, the only thing I can come up with is I'm supposed to show it to people.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason to have it.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, and so I said, well, this is perfect. You know, if your motives are pure, I think good things will happen to you. I mean, that's my philosophy.
Right. Again, you can have 100% of something, but it doesn't mean anything if you can't share it with other people.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely right. And I feel extremely fortunate to be able to be in this position where I can help facilitate this. You know, I was like, I've been blessed, you know. It's like, wow, thank you, you know, because all during this course of when I was showing, you know, doing museum shows, well, why don't you start your own museum? So, oh, man, yeah, you would have tasted start your own museum. I can't even start my car. And this thing dropped out of the sky on me. And it's like, wow, it couldn't have been more perfectly placed. Yeah. Riverside is the perfect town. Yeah. And we're trying to position it as the next great art town. And I think we will be able to do that.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming in. Is there anything else? Well, let me ask you a couple other questions before we wrap it up here. Okay. Did you get married?
Yeah, a bunch.
A bunch of times. No, you don't have to talk about all of them, but how many kids do you have?
I have 4 kids.
¿Cómo se llaman?
Carmen is my oldest. She's got 3 grandkids, and then Joey. He's in 32, also 38, 32. Jasmine is 25, and Max is 21.
All right. Did they all go to school?
Yeah, they all went to school.
That's the way to do it, Raza.
That's the only way to do it.
All right. What message do you have for the youngsters that want to get into art, that want to get into movies, that want to get into the industry?
Play as much as you can. There is no gig too small, because it's like there's like no push-up too small for you to get strong. You do push-ups, you're going to get strong. You play every day, whether it's live or in a play or for your brothers or sisters, you set up a little stage every day. That is going to the gym. And that's how you get stronger. So when you get your shot, because everybody's going to get a shot eventually. If you stay in it longer, you're going to get an opportunity. It's like being called out to bat. You know, okay, batting for number 43 is number 47, and you got to hit. You got it. But if you haven't been practicing up into that, you're not going to hit. But if you've been practicing up to that point and you're ready, smack it. You know, and that's what it is. There's it doesn't magically happen.
And you and Chong have made custom made up.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Are you still performing?
Yeah, we do. We play casinos. We've been performing now again for 10 years.
Wow.
It goes by like a fart in a dust storm. But we get along good enough to go out there and do it. You know, we play mostly casinos now, Indian casinos, because that's a really big source of employment for a lot of entertainers, and the casinos love us, and so we have the perfect demographic for them, people that are old enough to have money to spend on gambling, and they know us, and so we play. Every casino. I mean, there's more Indian casinos now than there were Indians when Columbus landed. I'm not kidding.
Yeah. All right. Any last messages? Anything else that you want to tell us?
Well, we want everybody within the sound of this program to donate to the Cheech Marin Center for Chicano Art, Culture, and Industry. And you can go to cheechmarin.com and find out all the information, or thecheech.com. That's what we've nicknamed the museum. And help support us and be part of this. What I want is for everybody to be a part of this. When you don't have to be Chicano, you have to be black, white, doesn't matter. Support art, because art is the only thing we leave behind as a culture. It says who we were, what we thought, what we held dear, what we cherished, what we believed in. I don't know if there's a museum dedicated to the art of the deal, but I know that there's many museums that you go to that have works of art that are thousands of years old, and people still go to see the pyramids or the Mona Lisa or Guernica. They mean something to us. They're the embodiment of our souls, and now we have a chance to show the very particular and important aspect of Chicano art, because Chicano art is American art, and it's a recognition of the Latino influence and contribution to this country.
There it is, Raza. Well, thank you for coming. You'll come back again, ¿verdad?
Absolutely, man.
Órale, pues. That's going to do it for us, Raza. We want to thank you all for tuning in. You've been listening to KUCR.org, also KUCR 88.3 FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Riverside. You've also been listening to the Radio Slam program every Friday night from 5:30 in the afternoon to 7 a.m. in the morning. That's KUCR 88.3 FM. You've also been listening to, of course, East LA Review. .com. That's REVUE.com. Ahí te guacho, raza. Hasta la próxima.
Ahí te guacho, Nacho. Hey, this is Chich Marin, and you're listening to EastLAReview.com. And take it slow, bro.
If you can, where were you born, man?
Huh? Where was I born?
That's right, I said, where were you born?
Hey, are you one of those dudes that do horoscopes, man? Hey, I'm a Cancer with a bad moon rising.
Look here, El Fago, watch my lips. Where were you born?
I was born in East L.A., man. I was born in East L.A.
Oh, yeah, you're born in East L.A. Well, let's see your green card, huh?
Green card? I'm from East L.A.
All right, well, then who's president of the United States?
Oh, that's easy, man. That guy that used to be on Death Valley days, John Wayne.
All right, let's go. Come on.
Easter egg!